back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Lady Broxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The United Nations say the Yemen blockade must end or thousands will die. And Save the Children says 130 kids are dying every day in Yemen. We are supplying bombs, we are supplying personnel, and we are supplying aircraft to kill those people. Well, you and me, of course. It's the increasingly centralised powers in Westminster that are doing all this. In Turkey, we hear the Kurdish YPG is trying to conquer the whole of that part of Syria. And in Saudi Arabia, the king is to step down and crown his 32-year-old son as the new king. That's reports are saying that anyway today. And Israelis are saying that they're ready to share Iran intelligence with the Saudis, not just Iran, other deals as well, no doubt. Maybe this new Saudi king will be an Israeli Saudi king. Also, fighting within ZANU-PF for succession, is it a coup or is it not a coup? And what, if any, is the role of the good old Pentagon, or AFRICOM for short? Getting ready for an epic war, starting with Iran, perhaps? Well, it's the Freemason and Confederate Captain Albert Pike's tune, his letter from the 1870s. We'll be having the final of two parts around about that this evening. Our sister show Dialect is on BCFM 93.2 here at noon every Tuesday. This week, Carol Higgins, an incredible struggle for justice after being sexually abused by her father, and a successful battle with cancer. She's an inspiration to us all. Plus, a little known corner of the Lord Mayor's Chapel, opposite College Green. We have a look into some 16th century Moorish influence on our city's architecture. Bet you didn't know about that. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you could download it too from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, let's start this week by having a look at this news from Saudi Arabia, with the possibility that the Saudi king will be stepping down and crowning his 32-year-old son as the new king. Are you surprised to hear that?
Well, no. I mean, MBS, as he is known, the new king, has been pretty much in charge for some time because his father is senile, not to put too fine a point on it.
His name's Mohammed Bin Salman. You like calling him MBS?
MBS is apparently his nickname.
Why might the Israelis actually be interested in making him king? What power do they have to do that?
Well, it may or may not be news to our listeners. It shouldn't be that the Israeli right wing and the Saudi right wing have actually got a shared enemy in Iran, and they are basically on the same page, along with us, of course. We're on their side,
okay,
too.
So the Persians are not really Arabs, but they're certainly all Muslims. How come Israel and the Muslim country of Saudi might be ganging up against other Muslims?
Well, because both Israel and Saudi Arabia are essentially Western-oriented puppet states. They are there to... they've got their own vested interest and their own ruling classes in both states, but those ruling classes are aligned with the United States and with Britain. And therefore, we're all on the same side, supposedly, to keep the masses in the Middle East in under the thumb, as they have been for several hundred years, and Britain has played a major role in that for all that time.
No, it's the Daily Mail that's reporting this. They say the King of Saudi Arabia plans to step down and announce his son as his successor next week. The move is seen as a final step in 32-year-old Prince Mohammed bin Salman's power grab, which began earlier this month. The arrest of more than 40 princes and government ministers. in a corruption probe. The source said King Salman will continue only as a ceremonial figurehead, handing over official leadership to the country to his son, often referred to, as you quite rightly said, as MBS. Unless something drastic happens, King Salman will announce the appointment of MBS as King of Saudi Arabia next week.
Well, that's right. And he's also basically pushing for a war with Iran. People out there need to listen and understand the Israeli leadership and the Saudi leadership and the American leadership want a war with Iran. They're speaking about it in words of fire 10 feet high. I ask you, people listening to this show, do you want to go to war with Iran? Because that's where our Conservative government is going to take us, because that's what all these other people want, and apparently we want it too. Do we want a war with Iran?
That is our democratically elected Conservative government, Mark.
That would be the one which hasn't actually got a mandate of 50% plus one of the vote. And of course, that wouldn't be counted as a legitimate regime in some parts of the world.
The DUP have elected to join them, haven't they?
Yes, but even if you add the DUP votes to the Tory vote, it's still not 50% plus one, unlike every other European country which has a different electoral setup. And of course, it's not the case in the United States. Trump didn't get 50% plus one of the vote in the United States, but we're supposed to just accept that. Of course, if it was in Russia and Putin had less than 50% of the vote, we'd be saying that he was illegitimate. We're saying he's illegitimate anyway, or the mainstream are, even though he's got something like 80% of the vote. But when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller, because actually the Western system lacks legitimacy. And if you're going to have a world war, you've got to have the legitimacy. And of course, the government in Iran, the government in Russia, and probably the government in China have got more popular support than the Western leadership.
Okay, antiwar.com is reporting Saudi Arabia is attacking Yemen, blockading the nation to a famine. They've also caused a regional row, a split with Qatar, and a threatening Lebanon. In its comments today, Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel Jubeir attributed every single action the Saudis have taken to Iranian aggression. Jubeir insisted this was obvious to everyone and that all Saudi actions have been their way of saying enough is enough to Iran. They believe, of course, that Iran is actually been interfering in Yemen, and that's why they had to go in there.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Basically, the Saudis and the West and the Israelis have been provoking war from the get-go. And if ultimately, they may get the war they claim to want, but whether they can win it is another question, whether it's in Lebanon or in Iran.
Okay, well, Haaretz today are also saying Israeli military chief is giving unprecedented interview to Saudi media, ready to share intelligence with Iran. So there is, if an intelligence sharing agreement, is that something that's been going on
with Saudi Arabia, not with Iran,
about Iran? Yeah. Sorry, yes, on Iran. Yeah. So this is Israel and Saudi Arabia are in full agreement about Iran's intentions. Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot tells Elaf, noting that the two states have never fought each other. And the Saudi newspapers published an unprecedented interview on Thursday with Israeli military chief, Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot. It marks the first time that any senior Israeli Defence Forces officer, let alone the chief of staff, has been interviewed by a media organisation in Saudi Arabia, which doesn't actually have official diplomatic ties with Israel. In the interview, Eisenkot called Iran the real and largest threat to the entire region.
Well, they've basically been cooperating for years, and all we're seeing now is that cooperation coming into the open. Ultimately, for example, if the Israelis were to carry out a strike on Iran, they could fly to Saudi Arabia and carry out the strike from Saudi soil, and that's definitely been discussed. But both Israel and Saudi Arabia are not strong enough to fight Iran on their own. What they're going to do is provoke a war with Iran and then turn round to the Americans and us, the British, and say, oh, we're at war with Iran now. Can you help us out, please? Because it's already started. And at that point, of course, the British should definitely say, no, you're on your own with this one.
Okay, a couple of stories to do with ISIS, because we're seeing apparently the end game of the attacks on ISIS. One is a domestic one, Martin. It's in the Daily Express saying that Britons returning from ISIS territory do not justify prosecution, says the terror watchdog. Britons returning from ISIS territory don't justify prosecution, and that is in the Express. That, I mean, it does sound a bit strange, isn't it? If you're off fighting for ISIS, surely when you come back, you should at least face questioning. But the government's new independent reviewer of terrorist legislation, Max Hill QC, says the authorities have decided not to charge returnees. He said, "We are told we do have a significant number already back in this country who have previously gone to Iraq and Syria." Now, the obvious question here, Martin, is what if these people start letting off bombs in Britain?
Well, the obvious question is, well, how did they get to Syria and Iraq in the first place? They were probably recruited by MI6, because ISIS, of course, is basically a Western front. Very interestingly, this week, the BBC have reported, can I just point this out, that at Raqqa, the Western-backed forces and the YPG, who we're probably going to cover in a moment, allowed thousands of ISIS fighters with weaponry to leave the city and disperse. Because in actual fact, the Western powers support ISIS.
Martin, that's part of a peace agreement, surely.
No, listen.
They're saying, look, if we, you let us take the city and we'll let you go.
Yeah, but at the same time, they've been bombing the city indiscriminately and killing many civilians. So it's not about saving civilian life.
Okay, so they would say, militarily, we bombed them to the position where they are now. They've now agreed to leave the city.
Well, you could say that, but the deal leads to a situation where thousands of... And also, of course, what's been pointed out by the Iranians and the Russians is that at Deir ez-Zor, US helicopters came in and took out foreign leaders of ISIS to be redeployed elsewhere. The Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, and the Syrian general staff have been saying this all along, that ISIS is in fact a front organisation for Saudi Arabia and the West. So, and of course, they are right.
So all this stuff with Peshmerga and also with Saudi Arabia in Israel starts to look as if this is the next stage of the game. Now ISIS is on its last legs.
That's right. Well, ISIS is basically a cat's paw that's deployed, like, you know, it's like a fox, and we breed foxes so that we can go tally ho, there's a fox, and then we can intervene.
And now we're in a situation with US bases in Syria, yeah, that the Russians have got to deal with.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, what the Kurds, the Kurdish forces, which are pressing on to try and take the oil fields in Syria, there's no Kurdish population in that area. But they're being pushed to take the oil fields to prevent the Syrian government from recapturing them. And of course, when ISIS carries out attacks in the West, because of their close links to the Saudis and Western intelligence services, we have to presume that those attacks are actually being carried out by our own intelligence services. That's what a serious police force, like the one in Italy, or possibly the one in Northern Ireland, would be starting to ask.
So what Reuters are saying is that recent developments in Syria's Raqqa show that the Kurdish YPG militia, backed by the United States, is more concerned about capturing territory than actually fighting Islamic State. The Turkish Foreign Minister, Melvin Cavusoglu, said in a speech yesterday. Turkey's expressed anger. A convoy of Islamic State fighters were allowed to withdraw from Raqqa last month as part of an agreement with the YPG, saying it was appalled by the US's stance on the issue. But I mean, you could see this as a merciful act, couldn't you?
Well, you could, but it's interesting that the BBC have reported it, and it's been totally ignored in the media in the United States. If we're going to have a policy of allowing ISIS fighters to escape from certain places and take their weaponry with them, then we need to discuss whether that is our policy or not. Rather than just presume, that's what we've agreed. Now, what the Russians are contending is that the YPG and ISIS are actually cooperating. And that's also what the Turks are saying, as you've just said, which is pretty rich, really, because the Turks were major supporters of ISIS when they were aligned with Western policy.
Yeah,
until the YPG appeared, and then they suddenly...
Until the coup attempt, surely. There's
yes,
been a whole
that's
switch,
right.
You know.
That's right.
Actually, ISIS, the beginning of the end of ISIS was the Russian intervention, yes, but also the coup attempt.
Yes, and the Russians intervened in that to warn Erdogan and basically saved his life. Now,
can we just get back to the domestic stuff? Because I think this is what will be concerning most people out there. What are MI5 doing, saying it's okay for ISIS people to come back? We know exactly who they are, and they're not going to be prosecuted.
Well,
it's not a decision, apparently, that MI5 and others will have taken lightly, new terror watchdog Chappie,
yeah, but look,
Max Hill says, they, I am sure, will have looked intensely at each individual on return?
They looked intensely at them before they went out there, because at the Old Bailey a couple of years ago, a guy was put on trial for preparing to go to Syria to fight for a jihadist group, and he defended himself by saying, yes, but the group itself was orchestrated by MI6, and it was MI6 who recruited me. Now, this is the reason why they're allowed to come back, is because in actual fact they're on the payroll, and that most of the terrorism that's been carried out in the Western countries since 9/11 has been orchestrated by the intelligence services using Islamists as the front. Okay, and that's been the fact. That's just the basic pattern of what we're talking about.
Let's start talking about specific numbers. An estimated 850 Britons have reportedly travelled to Syria in the last 6 years, with 120 apparently killed in fighting. That leaves, 630. Half of those remaining are said to have already returned to the UK, but they won't be prosecuted.
No, because don't forget, the intelligence services would say, oh, we're just keeping an eye on them to see what they lead us to, blah, 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 blah. But in actual fact...
What have they been being trained to do out in Syria?
Well, they've probably been trained to do pretty similar to the Manchester bomber was trained to do, which is to actually build a viable bomb. And he was trained to build a viable bomb probably when he was in Libya, probably trained by somebody from Hereford who knows how to build viable bombs. That's the reality. As we go into World War III, and that's where we're going, Tony, people have got to face the facts that our intelligence services and special forces are the source of Islamist terrorism. The two things are absolutely linked, not just in Syria where it's absolutely obvious, but also back here when attacks take place. And the police force have got to take a step back and start really investigating these incidents.
Oh, sorry, but they've just been cut. There are hardly any police left.
Indeed, and of course, as we all know, they are way down the food chain compared to the intelligence services. But if the police force don't get their finger out, and of course, in Italy, the police force did get its finger out. It took them decades, but they pointed the finger very firmly at NATO intelligence services as the source of terrorism.
Okay, as this trouble spreads, now ISIS have been defeated to places like Saudi Arabia, to Yemen, also Lebanon. Lebanese Prime Minister has accepted an invite to France. Claims that Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri is definitely not being held against his will in Saudi Arabia. Well, poppycock, I say. And he was going to return to Lebanon within 2 days. Absolute nonsense. Well, it definitely won't be coming to pass. Instead, Hariri is going to France.
That's because Macron went for a chat with MBS. And of course everybody's lining up now for this war with Iran in the Middle East, which I stress to our listeners, that's where we're going. Do you want a war with Iran? Because if you don't, you better start thinking about what you're going to do to stop it.
Okay, what about the claims about Russia today in Washington, which bizarrely I appeared on like a week before they started making a big fuss about it on the Sean Stone program, Watching the Hawks, for 20 minutes or so, and that actually does look as if now the Russians are starting to bite back. Actually, they're naming 9 US funded media outlets which will face foreign agents over in Russia. They've sent written notices to Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, informing them that they will be affected by the Russian Parliament's new media law allowing for the labelling of certain foreign media as foreign agents.
Well, it's this sort of tit for tattery is the run-up to a world war. So that's what's happening.
We've had interviews on Newsnight and on the Daily Politics with people from RT. They're saying effectively that RT is in complete denial about the hacking of the US election, effectively spinning the US election and affecting elections. I mean, you're not going to try and deny, are you, that Russia does this kind of thing?
I am, because the evidence is, if there was any solid evidence, we would have seen it. And we haven't seen anything.
This week, Theresa May has also added her voice to those saying that Russians are interfering in British general elections too.
Although she's rode back on that this very day, because in actual fact, as she saw in her Mansion House speech, she didn't give a single example of what she was talking about. And she said, well, I don't mean that they've interfered in Britain in the Brexit vote. I just mean that in general, they've interfered. And what they mean by interfered is Russia Today has acted like a news organisation reporting on elections, and that is interference as far as they're concerned.
Now, haven't the US a bit of a record of interfering in elections?
They do indeed.
The
National Endowment for Democracy in the United States will no doubt spend millions of taxpayer dollars in Russia in the run-up to the presidential election in March. They will fund the people they want, probably Alexei Navalny, to a very large extent. He won't win, but they will spend an awful lot of money to try and get him elected. And don't forget that Al Jazeera discovered that the Israeli government had spent £1 million inside the British Labour Party to try and control the policy.
Well, I don't
now, that's the sort of thing that goes on out there.
They didn't say they'd spent £1 million. They said they had £1 million slush fund for anyone that was willing to actually bring Israeli lobbying into the Labour Party through new lobby groups within the party.
Indeed. Now, the fact is that the Russians have got a fraction of the resources that the West has got. They obviously try and get their message out there. They obviously try and communicate, you know, their desires and wishes.
They've got a massive, they've got a massive military, and also Russia today is an enormous network.
It's an enormous network.
Millions of viewers.
Yes, but it's got millions of viewers, but in terms of resources, it's absolutely minuscule compared to things like Sky News, for example, or Fox.
Which, by the way, are having financial trouble. The Murdoch empire is, apparently.
Well, that's because all conventional media are being undermined by the revolution in internet technology and so on.
I mean, this classifying these as foreign agents, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, there are 9 outlets apparently in Russia that are going to be going to be affected by this, and they are all just different language versions, apparently, of Radio Free Europe, which targets various parts of the Russian Federation. Now, I mean, both sides are doing this. What's the problem?
Well, if both sides are doing it, let's have no Queensbury rules, gloves off, and just punching. And on that basis, the Kiev snipers, the snipers that actually carried out the shootings in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the Ukraine crisis, they were in Il Giornale, which is an Italian newspaper this week, saying, we were brought in from Georgia to shoot both police and protesters, and we were working for the current government, not the Yanukovych government, the current government. So in actual fact, the Western intelligence services killed those protesters on the Maidan Square. The Kiev snipers who did it have actually confessed this week in Il Giornale, which is an Italian newspaper. Is that going to be broadcast on the BBC, that we killed those people? Because of course the contention is that it was the pro-Russian government that had killed those people, but in actual fact it wasn't them, it was us. It was us, and okay, of course the weaponry probably came from Britain, and the training was at Warsaw Police Academy.
There was some evidence actually on a BBC documentary about it that it was British weapons.
Yes,
anyway,
indeed.
Anyway, let's just quote from Il Journal. This article we'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Well, it's in Italian, so hopefully you'll have some translation system, not necessarily Google, the evil Google, to translate it for you. Everyone started shooting 2 or 3 shots at a time. It went on for 15 or 20 minutes. We had no choice. We were ordered to shoot both on the police and on the demonstrators without any difference. I was totally outraged. But, I mean, you know, how can a soldier say he's got no choice when he's ordered to shoot?
These were mercenaries brought in from Georgia, related to Shakashvili. Now, we don't know what the full detail. We've always suspected that this was what took place, because Umas Piats, the Estonian foreign minister, gave a telephone call to Catherine Ashton, who was the EU's representative, and said, well, the information we're getting is that the snipers who killed these people were working for the new regime, not the old regime, the new regime. And of course, the new regime was working very closely with guess who? CIA, MI6. Those people that are supporting ISIS. The same stuff. And it's exactly the same plot and plan in every situation. It's create chaos and then use that chaos to try and advance your political goals. And it is terrorism by any definition. And it's our secret services who are the main perpetrators.
Also looking over at the Asia Pacific region, meeting with Japanese Defence Minister, the US Pacific Commander Admiral Harry Harris emphasised yesterday the role of America's massive military presence in the Pacific plays in any potential diplomatic efforts towards North Korea. Clearly, he said, while diplomacy must be the main effort with North Korea, it has to be diplomacy backed by credible military power, Harris insisted at the start of the meeting. That diplomacy is the main focus at all is something the US officials have been loath to admit. US idea of a credible military power, it seems, hinges heavily on threats to start a massive war unilaterally. So what is the strategy here? Is this just saber-rattling, or is there any real strategy?
I don't think they have got a real strategy, because once North Korea has got nuclear weapons, and it's perfectly logical why they've got nuclear weapons, it's the same logic why Britain's got nuclear weapons. It's just an insurance policy. And once they've got nuclear weapons, war is actually impossible unless you're going to have a nuclear war.
More about North Korea today. Apparently North Korea's got a secret weapon. Kim Jong-un sets alarm bells ringing in the United States with shock pictures of some kind of special way of terrifying weapon of some sort to sink ships. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works, but I mean, is this real? Is it propaganda? I mean, it does seem as if the North Koreans are generating stuff. I mean, we've seen before, haven't we, that in their military parades there have actually been ballistic missiles that are made of wood. So they're just trying to pretend, I guess.
Well, we don't know is the simple answer, but you've got to recognise that the era of the aircraft carrier is definitely over.
Well,
the US has a preponderance of aircraft carriers, but they are effectively just great big sitting targets in the modern era.
They're developing apparently powerful new submarines capable of firing deadly ballistic missiles from the sub.
Well, that's the same technology as we've got with Trident, and they're developing it for the same reasons we're developing it, just in case somebody attacks them. They won't dare because we've got this, they're not relying on the Chinese nuclear umbrella, nor do we rely upon the US nuclear umbrella. That's why Britain has an independent deterrent, so-called.
How can we stop North Korea's aggressive building schedule?
We can't. North Korea has developed nuclear weapons, just like Pakistan, just like Israel, just like South Africa did, although they got rid of them. And once a country becomes a nuclear country, then that's it. You cannot attack them without starting a nuclear war. That's exactly why they've developed nuclear weapons. The logic of it is impeccable, because they haven't been, they agreed not to develop nuclear weapons in the 90s and started to build peaceful nuclear program and cooperate with the South. And that's how eventually you might have developed a dynamic to some kind of solution of that conflict.
Let's just have a look at two stories. I mean, we dealt already with this first one, which is Britain's, and the headline in the Daily Express was Britain's returning from ISIS territory do not justify prosecution, says the terror watchdog. But on the other hand, there's an EU terror warning. The United States has issued winter travel alert amidst heightened threats in Europe. So how do we square these two?
It's quite straightforward, Tony. Basically, most of this so-called terrorist threat, particularly the Islamist terrorist threat, is orchestrated by Western intelligence services. They set up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s. They created ISIS, as General Flynn pointed out when he was interviewed. ISIS was created by the West. Al-Baghdadi met with John McCain when John McCain went to inside Syria. And so the main population are bombarded with propaganda about ISIS are out to get you, Al-Qaeda are the enemy, these terrible people are trying to blow you up. Oh, they have blown you up. But in actual fact, these organisations are orchestrated by the Western intelligence services working very closely with the Saudis, bringing the circle back round again.
Well,
MBS.
We mentioned the media and this sort of media war between Washington and Russia. Also this week, a BBC journalist, this is reported by Middle East Monitor, has deleted her tweet about Britain's corrupt relationship with Israel. This is Laura Koonsberg, prominent BBC journalist, deleted a tweet in which a senior Tory MP can be seen complaining about the British media turning a blind eye to the corrupt relationship that has allowed Israel to buy access to Westminster. The tweet was posted by the BBC's political editor Laura Koonsberg on Wednesday, while the Scottish journalist was covering the build-up to the resignation of Priti Patel. This is last week. The Secretary of State for International Development had taken part in undisclosed meetings in Israel organised by the powerful Conservative Friends of Israel lobby. The Twitter post on the day, which some bright sparks saved, she says strong words. A senior Tory says Lord Pollack should be chucked out of the party, claiming the entire apparatus has turned a blind eye to a corrupt relationship that allows a country to buy access, referring to Israel. Strong words, she tweeted, but then she deleted her tweet.
Well, she's no doubt had her arm twisted up her back. Because that demonstrates the point that she made in the tweet itself, doesn't it?
The Middle East Monitor contacted Koonsberg to see why she deleted the tweet, but she didn't. They didn't get a reply. So it does seem as if there is this Israel lobby still, Martin, very powerful here in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that would be a decisive factor if it does come to a war with Iran and between Iran and Israel, and especially if Saudi Arabia weighs in as well, a great friend of ours, apparently, because they supply so much of our oil.
Well, I don't know if we get a lot of our oil from Saudi Arabia. They buy an awful lot of our weaponry, but that's another matter. Yes, I'm quite sure that the establishment in this country is definitely in the pocket of the Saudis and the Israelis. But I think the ordinary people in this country, A, haven't been warned that they're going to war with Iran, and B, there's no guarantee that they're going to support it. If the Tory government takes us to war with Iran to support Saudi Arabia and Israel, they deserve to be drummed out of office forthwith. And hopefully that's exactly what would happen.
In the meantime, we've heard this week that a homeless ex-soldier, 82 years old, has died hours after being evicted from his squat. This is reported in the Daily Mirror. A pretty horrific, Martin, that someone should be evicted aged 82, especially an ex-soldier. And I just wonder... It says other homeless ex-servicemen took the man, known only as George, to hospital, but he passed away with them at his bedside. He was basically found just lying in the street.
Well, we were talking about universal credit in the first hour, and all the evidence shows that introduction of universal credit will massively increase homelessness. Massively. Because lots of people will simply fall into rent arrears and be evicted. Just as you said, in the run-up to Christmas, is a fantastic Christmas present for the poorest people in the country from our glorious government, eh?
What's the solution to the homelessness problem?
Well, the obvious thing to do, and what we should have been doing since 1979, is building social housing at affordable rents for lower-income people.
George had been living in a disused building in Manchester with 12 other homeless ex-servicemen before they were all evicted. Well, that's a couple of those, and you've got a platoon. Maybe they could fight back and actually get themselves somewhere permanent.
Well, the long-run solutions, as we know, are to provide low-cost housing. In the short run, of course, squatting should be decriminalised and people should be recognised for doing what they're doing as a necessity, because there isn't anywhere else for them to go.
Is there anything we could do in Bristol, do you think, particularly to make sure that particularly the elderly are not just... I mean, this guy was 82 years old and not just left homeless?
Well, the obvious thing to do is, A, as we're saying, is to try and build more low-cost housing, decriminalise squatting so that if people need to squat, then they can without being persecuted, and also, of course, support the charities which are doing their best to try and help the people at the bottom of the pile. But things are going to get worse before they get any better, aren't they?
Councils are sending the bailiffs around 2 million times in a year. It doesn't sound like Bristol City Council, if they're part of this, are paying any attention to you at all. That's another Daily Mirror article, which also includes your rights if one turns up at your door. Unpaid council tax and parking fines and rent resulted in more than 2 million bailiffs being sent to people's homes.
Well, that was one of the reasons why they didn't introduce council tax or poll tax in Northern Ireland, because during the census in the 1970s, people who went round just to collect the census were assassinated. And of course, you can imagine private sector bailiffs turning up on the Falls Road to take away people's tellies. They're likely to end up dead in a ditch. And of course, once you've got the rate, during the rates era, bailiffs weren't involved in collecting rates. Rates are very simple to collect. If a property which owes the rates doesn't pay the money that it's owed, the property is impounded. The bailiffs don't have to get involved. Bailiffs are only used to chase poor people for small amounts of money. And of course, they couldn't bring that in Northern Ireland, either on the Falls or the Shankill Road, because anybody who tried to take away people's tellies would end up dead.
This horrifying division between rich and poor is put into sharp focus this week, as Oxfam has said the world's 8 richest people have the same wealth as the poorest 50%.
Well, that's right, and that's largely to do with the QE policies that have been pursued since the crash, which allow free money to be printed by governments, which is then given to banks, private banks, which is then used to push asset prices up.
Well, a lot of this is coming in share dividends, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, because the stock market's being goosed up with public resources, which, of course, is not supposed to happen. It's completely against the textbook, but hey, the textbook's in the race paper basket.
The Guardian puts it this way, similar thing. It's Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, I've never heard of, and Warren Buffett, who I have. The three of them are all wealthier than the poorest half of America.
Well, that's right. And this has been going on for decades now. the creation of a super elite who await, you know, they what should have happened in 2008 when the system collapsed is they should have been allowed to lose all their money. But of course, you can't do that because then capitalism has to end, and we can't end capitalism. So the taxpayer, the ordinary punters, have to stump up and sacrifice so that the multi-billionaires can get even more, can get even wealthier. But at a certain point, of course, the tumbrils roll and the guillotines come out.
To protect John Redwood's job as an investment manager, he warned his wealthy clients to get their money out before disaster hits. Now, this, I think, is relating to Brexit, isn't it?
Yep.
Even though he's a major Brexiteer,
yes,
he's saying get your money out.
Well, as a politician, Redwood is constantly pushing the idea that Brexit is going to be a great success, and that people who are downsaying it are just undermining the Britain, blah, blah, blah. But as a fund manager in the city, he's saying get your money out now because Britain's going to crash. You couldn't make it up, could you?
Also, Philip May, the Prime Minister's husband, has questions to answer, apparently, over the Paradise Papers. His company is linked to investments made via offshore tax havens in the Paradise Papers. So this is this company he's one of the major partners in, Philip May, who's a strange character. I think we had a programme not long after Theresa May came to power where we had his laugh on the programme, which was a very strange kind of almost like a robotic laugh. And he was saying... he's saying effectively that this it's called Capital Group, based in Los Angeles, with investments in companies like Starbucks and Lockheed Martin.
Yes, and is it any wonder that our glorious Prime Minister is less than enthusiastic about closing down tax havens when her husband is a major seller
Who's in charge? Who's wearing the trousers? Surely he just tells her what to do.
I think that's a slightly sexist remark.
Why? Martin, that's not sexist. I think he's the one with a much more powerful financial interest in what happens at number 10.
I would just suggest this. It's pretty obvious there's a conflict of interest there. I'll say no more than that.
Labour has said Theresa May's husband, Philip, has serious questions to answer about his firm's links to possible tax avoidance. Private Eye has seen emails that suggest Mr. May's company, Capital Group, used an offshore law firm called Appleby to arrange investments for clients in tax havens. Documents suggest they funds registered in the Cayman Islands, which were used to investments in South American agriculture company called El Tejar. The Shadow Minister for Cabinet Office, John Trickett, said there's some serious questions Philip May to answer, but of course he won't be answering them, Martin, will he?
And if he doesn't answer them, then politically, I hope the government pays the price. You don't have to say anything, and anything you do say may be taken down and used as evidence against you.
Local MP, Conservative MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, North Somerset, says we must give the National Health Service £350 million a week post-Brexit. Now, what he's saying is that this promise that was made on the bus must be upheld.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if that happens, because in actual fact they haven't got £350 million to give it, because the fact is that we're not going to get that money back from Brussels anytime soon. They could spend the money anyway, but then they'll have to give up the fantasy that they're reducing the deficit.
So it's a bit of
a no-win situation for them, isn't it?
What's behind this comment from Rees-Mogg, if you think it's not possible anyway?
Well, I think what he's doing is he's politicking in terms of internal fights inside the Tory party. They're trying to make life as difficult as possible for people like Hammond. I understand Michael Gove fancies his chances as Chancellor of the Exchequer. So they're basically on the bridge. The officer class are stabbing each other in the back and in the front. Meanwhile, the ship is sinking.
Carl Sargent over in Wales was not given a natural justice, his family said. This is the poor Welsh politician, Labour politician, who committed suicide about 10 days ago. He was found dead after being sacked from the cabinet and suspended from Labour. Now, there are some pretty shocking pictures of the celebrations that went on by the cabinet and the Welsh Labour cabinet in Cardiff when his sacking was announced, Martin.
Well, I don't know whether...
Basically, he's a Corbynista and they're very pleased they've got rid of him. And then he committed suicide.
Well, the whole thing is extremely sad. If he was involved in bad behaviour, that's reprehensible. But I don't think anybody deserves to die for carrying out sexual harassment.
What about
it's not proportionate, is it?
Making this whole thing entire thing public without actually telling him what he's alleged to have done.
Well, that's what his family are saying. And I think what's required here, and I think Jeremy Corbyn has said this, we need to look at our procedures for dealing with this thoroughly. There's got to be people who complain of sexual harassment should be treated with absolute seriousness. It's an incredibly serious allegation, and it's to be treated with a complete seriousness. But on the other hand, people also have to be treated as innocent till proven guilty. Otherwise, we don't know.
But he was sacked.
Yeah, we haven't. This is the issue about the procedure, isn't it? If you're going to, he was suspended. He wasn't sacked, as I understand it.
No, he was sacked, and he should have been suspended.
And
it was seen as an opportunity for a Blairite Labour administration to get rid of a Corbynite from North Wales.
If that is the case, then that is reprehensible, Tony. But I don't know enough about the case to wade in. We've got to see natural justice done, both to people who complain of being harassed and to those who are complained against.
What about all these claims of bullying there've been by the Carwyn Jones? The Welsh leader.
I have no comment to make because I haven't the faintest idea whether they're true or not. If they are true, then that's reprehensible.
Also, will UK banks be sharing your details with organised crime? This is a fascinating story in the Mail. Fears are growing that open banking will increase the threat of fraud. Massive shake-up is going to force banks to share their financial details with third parties. Concerns are growing cyber criminals will exploit the new banking rules. Companies will be held accountable and banks will pay refunds if customers dispute a payment. Now, well, this is talking about a new era of banking, which will be ushered in from January next year. Security experts say it will put people at much greater risk of scams and identity theft. Under the new open banking rules, Britain's biggest banks will be forced to share customer data with companies that demand it. Providers of other payment accounts, such as credit cards, some savings accounts, will have to do the same under European Union legislation. As part of the second Payment Services Directive, something called PSD2. Some banks have already sent letters to customers warning third parties will be able to access their personal data from January.
Well, I mean, this is the first I've heard of this story, but increasingly we live in an Orwellian world, do we not? Where we are being constantly monitored and observed, but we don't know by who, and we don't know to what ends.
Why might they be doing this, since this will aid identity thieves?
I've no idea, Tony.
Also, there is a kind of move towards and away from cash and towards electronic banking. The Financial Conduct Authority apparently will be governing these organisations that these details are being shared with. But do you have any confidence in the regulators, the city regulators we've got?
No, and of course the drive to get rid of cash is part of the crisis. Because if you've got to keep your money in a bank, that helps to prop the banks up. And of course, they've tried to introduce, get rid of cash in India, the Narendra Modi right-wing regime in India, which Priti Patel is pretty close. She's supported Narendra Modi's policy of trying to get rid of cash. But in India, where the vast majority of the population don't have bank accounts, many of them don't even have electricity, it's a completely absurd policy, which has caused enormous suffering. But it's part of a general policy being pursued throughout the world by the financial elite to basically make sure that we are all in their field of fire. They will control us. If they control the electronic money and you can't get electronic money without going to them, then they control the population, and that's the strategy.
Blacklisted News, I rather like. They this week had one of their tweets and one of their articles on their website. Is America becoming a police state where churches can't feed the homeless and kids can't set up lemonade stands? And they're quoting various incidents where people have been either harassed by the police and told that they've got to take their places where they're giving away free food down, or arrested. Some of them even jailed for just handing out food.
Well, I mean, we're moving towards a social conflagration. It's been coming since 2008 and the so-called crash bailout, whatever it was. and you know, things are finally coming to a head.
Just one example, in Porterville in California, in this article, fascinating article on Blacklisted News, a five-year-old girl who set up a lemonade stand to raise money to buy herself a new bike was told 4 months later that she needed a business license to do it. Her mother received a warning and a citation from City Hall, which told her she had to send back $59, a local fee for applying for a new license, plus a fine.
Well, that's very reprehensible, but it's minor stuff. Much more important is
the
attempt
to get...
Well, I'm
saying it's the thin end of the wedge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't this... actually, what seems to be happening... Look, let's just take a step back from stories like that. Is that local authorities, in this case a city council in the United States, are turning into businesses. And there's people sitting there thinking, how can we make money? Any way we can make money, let's try and do it. And that's just another example.
Well, they're also, even if they're not being businesses, they're like Bristol City Council. They've got to try and raise money from somewhere to pay for the things that they want to do, because they've got no resources. So the public realm is being denuded of resources, and the private realm, or the realm of private interests, are being goosed up with public resources. And this has been going on for quite a long time now, and we're now reaching the apogee of this policy.
Well, just looking at the Blacklisted News website tonight, their headline is, "The world's first human head transplant has been successfully carried out in China." In an 18-hour operation, it showed it was possible to successfully reconnect the spine, the nerves, and the blood vessels. Pretty gory stuff. But, I mean, this is... It was another era. People would have just said, this is unethical, we're not going to allow you to do it.
Well, if you think about it, a head transplant basically is putting... It's actually a body transplant for the head, isn't it? It's the head that's being rescued. The body doesn't... The body is being put onto is there to preserve the head, I presume, rather than the other way
around. Actually,
round.
It says... I mean, sorry, we shouldn't be laughing, really. This is from the Daily Telegraph. The world's first human head transplant was carried out on a corpse in China. So it's not all light.
Well, so it's not really that. That's not really that helpful, is it?
Well, yes, but what are they? I mean, they're experimenting with this in order to try and get to do it on live human beings.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily stupid. It might be useful at some point, but it's not. You know, I just don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to have a little look at something which I was going to listen to in the first hour, we didn't have time to, which is HS2. And here is Dennis Skinner from a couple of weeks ago at Prime Minister's Questions asking about the rail project.
Dennis Skinner. Yeah. Is the Prime Minister aware there's been some very powerful research done on the question of high-speed rail? What it says is that in the leafy suburbs of the south, the first 140 miles, 30% of it has been dedicated to tunnelling to avoid knocking houses down. Yet in the north, we are now told that the percentage is only 2% for the whole of the north.
So no.
Why? Because HS2 says it's too costly, knock the houses down. Will she arrange for a meeting with people from my area in order to avoid another 30 houses being knocked down in Newton, part of Bolsover? And isn't it high time that this government stop treating our people like second-class citizens?
I say to the Honourable Gentleman that I'm sure the Department of Transport, will be happy to look into the question that he has raised. But of course, HS2, the reason why we're doing HS2 is that it is important to increase the capacity of the railway lines going through to the north. This will be a very important contribution to the United Kingdom economy. And I can assure him, if he looks at everything that this government has done with the Northern Powerhouse, the Midlands Engine, the... The significant investment across in infrastructure across all parts of the country. This is a government that wants to ensure this is a country that works for everyone.
Now, it's Theresa May, the Prime Minister, replying to Dennis Skinner, the Labour Party member for Bolsover's question about HS2. Martin, the news is this week that HS2 will be the most expensive railway on earth at £403 million a mile.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of HS2. And of course, what all it does really is if the conception of it is wrong, it's connecting the undeveloped north to the developed south. Whereas obviously what I would suggest is that the money should be spent is in creating rail infrastructure in the north.
Well, reopening. So, how about reopening rail infrastructure?
Yeah, well, you know, the, if you want to actually help the north,
rail travel to cut down on congestion. But then we won't be able to have a congestion charge.
No, well, that's the congestion charge is a red herring in this context, I would suggest to you. The problem is
£111 billion. Apparently, this is really going to cost. This is one of the latest accurate estimates.
Yeah, but all that will happen is that people will be able to move more quickly down to London to do. You know, the idea is that connecting the north to London directly by HS2 will benefit the north. It's just as likely to suck resources from the north down to London. It makes much more sense to me to upgrade the rail infrastructure from, say, Manchester to Leeds.
Well, Manfred Petrich, we're going to hear from him next week on HS2. We'll have to leave that till next week. But he's suggesting that for that money, you can build a railway all the way around the world. And I don't know, I mean, it does seem so utterly corrupt, this HS2 project. Anyway, let's leave that for now, because we're going to go back to the Albert Pike story. And this is continued from last week from a chap called Jean-Pierre de Smet, who's from South Africa. And here he talks about World War III with atheists versus nihilists.
Now, how were they going to do it? Let's read what Albert Pike wrote about these wars and how they were going to be unleashed. He wrote, quote, "We shall unleash the nihilist and the atheist," so the destroyer and the atheist, "and we will provoke a formidable social cataclysm which in its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism. Origin of savagery and the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens obliged to defend themselves against the minority of revolutionaries will exterminate these destroyers of civilization, and the multitude disillusioned with Christianity will receive the pure light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer. The destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." Wow, what a clever plan. So you rub the two systems which you create up against the other. You create atheism as an antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture. You have these two clash until they rub each other up. And then out of that, you will get a new world order where you have a new religion which is far more esoteric and actually honors Satan. Isn't that a rather clever plan?
So that's Jean-Pierre de Smet there. I'll put a link up to the Daily Express article about the Albert Pike letter. Not saying it's true, just a fascinating way of taking a step back from history and looking at what might be going on with all these world wars. And it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was National Health Service Finance Manager and Labour Party member Esther Giles. Her event is going on just next to All Hallows Hall, All Hallows Street here in Easton at 1 o'clock tomorrow, looking at the city's budget and, in fact, all the core cities across the country. Also, thanks to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1983 from Rufus and Chaka Khan. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.